Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
This article comes to us from frontiersin.org, and it's titled, Ear Muscle We Thought Humans Didn't Use, Except for Wiggling Our Ears, Actually Activates When People Listen Hard.
Ooh. Yeah. Can y'all wiggle your ears? I can.
I cannot. No.
Oh, I'm special. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
But so I think I know what they're talking about here, because you know how cats, when they hear a noise, their ears will kind of like go backwards very quickly? Do y'all ever get that when you hear a noise? Like something inside my ear twinges and I can tell like my ears are trying to rotate, but they can't.
Huh.
And I think that's what they're talking about in this article. So if you can wiggle your ears, you can use muscles that helped our distant ancestors listen closely. These auricular muscles helped change the shape of the pinna, or the shell of the ear, funneling sound to the eardrums. Millions of years ago, our ancestors stopped using them, so humans' auricular muscles are only vestigial. But now scientists examining the function of these muscles have discovered that they activate when we're trying to listen to competing sounds. Andreas Schroer of Saarland University, first author of the study in Frontiers in Neuroscience, says, there are three large muscles which connect the auricle to the skull and are important for ear wiggling. These muscles, particularly the superior auricle muscle, exhibit increased activity during effortful listening tasks. This suggests that these muscles are engaged not merely as a reflex, but potentially as part of an attentional effort mechanism, especially in challenging auditory environments.
Mm.
Similar research has already shown that the largest muscles, posterior and superior auricular muscles, react during attentive listening. Because they pull the ears up and back, they are considered likely to have been involved in moving the pinna to capture sounds. Schroer said, the exact reason these became vestigial is difficult to tell, as our ancestors lost this ability about 25 million years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's been a while. One possible explanation could be that the evolutionary pressure to move the ears ceased because we became much more proficient with our visual and vocal systems.
Hmm.
To test whether these muscles are more active during more difficult listening tasks, the scientists recruited 20 people without hearing problems. They applied electrodes to participants' auricular muscles and then played them an audiobook and distracting podcasts from speakers in front of or behind them. Huh. Each participant underwent 12 5-minute trials covering 3 different levels of difficulty. On easy mode, the podcast was quieter than the audiobook, and the speaker's voice was a stronger contrast to the audiobook. To create 2 more difficult modes, the scientists added a podcast that sounded more like the audiobook and made the distractors louder. However, the researchers were careful to make even the most difficult condition achievable, because if the participants gave up, no physiological effort would register. Then the scientists quizzed the participants on the audiobook's content. And the scientists found that the 2 auricular muscles reacted differently to the different conditions. The posterior auricular muscles reacted to changes in direction, while the superior auricular muscles reacted to the difficulty level of the task.
Huh.
Schroer said, the ear movements that could be generated by the signals we've recorded are so minuscule that there is probably no perceivable benefit. However, the auricle itself does contribute to our ability to localize sounds, so our auriculomotor system probably tries its best after being vestigial for 25 million years, but does not achieve much.
Huh. Like, I wonder, since you can move your ears, I have a question.
Uh-huh, yes.
When you're in, like, a loud restaurant bar situation?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have the same kind of issues that some of us have? I'm pretty bad at it, that I lose everything. So I have to watch people's lips in that situation. Like, I can't hear everything because I can't move my ears at all.
I mean, I definitely, like, if I'm in a loud situation, I'll struggle to hear stuff.
I find
as I get older, it's much more about how distractible I am. Like, concentration wise, it's like I heard the words, but I just can't put them together because I'm, you know, there's other stuff going on. And maybe that's really hearing, or maybe it's processing, and I just can't really distinguish them because I'm in the middle of it.
Right.
I am now definitely, when I'm trying to listen to something, I'm going to tighten those muscles and see if I can hear better. That would be useful to know.
Right.
Because, yeah, I mean, I started wiggling them when I was very, very young, and I didn't even know what I was doing, because I've worn glasses since I was 3 years old. And I thought as a child that I was wiggling my glasses. Because when I wiggle my ears, my glasses move a little bit in and out from my eyes. And I was like, look, I can wiggle my glasses. And then somebody was like, no, you're wiggling your ears. Your glasses are not a part of your body, you idiot.
Yeah, I'm imagining you in a bar situation, just like lifting your ears to listen more closely and like putting them back down.
Right. Like I'm fully like a horse. I'm like, whoop, turning them in the direction.
Next link.
Next link.
This comes from Science News. Can you actually die of a broken heart?
I mean, I have to assume yes.
Yes, I have heard that.
Yeah, so there's some science involved, right? So passing away from heartbreak, it's definitely a trope that we've heard in myth and fantasy. Now, they wrongly say in here that Padme died of a broken heart. So she got some Star Wars lore wrong in this. So I'm going to let that go. That's okay.
This is how much of a not Star Wars nerd I am. I was like, I do not know who that is. What are you talking about?
I had a very Glaven moment in here. I was like, no, that's not right. That's not what she died to, his childbirth. But King Lear apparently died of it, right? And it's possible that these characters fell to what's called Takotsubo syndrome, a short, intense dysfunction in the heart's left ventricle. It can occur after extreme emotional or physical stress, making heartbreak both real and potentially deadly.
Hmm.
While dying of heartbreak has been a popular theme in fiction for a long time, clinicians only began documenting real cases in the 1960s. According to Trisha Singh, a cardiologist at the University of Dorset in England, as imaging technology improved, doctors could directly study the hearts of afflicted patients. In many, the left ventricle, the chamber that pumps oxygenated blood to the body, balloons out. The shape reminded Japanese clinicians of a takotsubo, a round jar for catching lobsters and octopuses. And in 1990, cardiologist Hikaru Satou and colleagues at Hiroshima City Hospital proposed the term to describe the condition, much to the dismay of many English speakers.
Yeah, but also we can't exactly call it octopus jar heart. Like, that's terrible.
Lobster jar heart.
Right. Yeah.
What triggers it is still something of a mystery. One hypothesis is an acute traumatic event causes a surge of stress hormones, such as norepinephrine in the brain and epinephrine in the adrenal glands. Because the left ventricle is especially rich in receptors for these chemicals, a sudden flood could cause the taut elastic muscles to become loose and puffy, making it incapable of delivering enough blood to the body. With the majority of cases observed in postmenopausal women, it's also possible that reduced estrogen plays a role in this.
Mm.
The syndrome is relatively rare, so you don't have to worry, y'all, accounting for only about 2% of people who seek medical care for an apparent heart attack. The cardiologist Peter Rocco of the University of Wisconsin recalls a case from the 1980s. An older woman was called into the hospital in rural Wisconsin and shown a body of her son, who had died in a car accident. Within 5 minutes, she started having severe chest pain and collapsed on the floor. So she was flown to Madison, where Rocco snaked a catheter into her heart to see if blockage was causing the heart attack. To his surprise, her arteries were totally normal, but her heart function was dramatically reduced.
Wow.
In the syndrome, the heart vessels are often clear. In fact, most patients don't have any critical risk heart factors before it.
Hmm.
Today, reduced heart function with no clear signs of disease, that's a tip-off. In some cases, tragic events are obvious. But in other events, more long-term effects like COVID-19 or earthquakes in New Zealand, they have that one linked.
Hmm.
And many patients also have mental illness such as anxiety or depression.
Mm-hmm.
Though severe, it's remarkably short-lived and typically not fatal. About 4% of sufferers die, while 75% fully recover after 10 days.
All right.
Many recover after only 48 to 72 hours. It's absolutely incredible, Sin says. I remember seeing a lady who'd come in and her left ventricle function was severely impaired, and I came back and rescanned her 6 hours later, and it had gone from severely impaired to almost normal.
Hmm.
you know, sometimes you're like, maybe I should just leave it and I'll let it go. I don't need to go to the doctor.
Yeah. And yeah. 6 hours later, you were right. So
yeah, or almost dead. Died and it was fine.
It was fine. I didn't need that $6,000 ER bill.
Well, and I wonder, like, if somebody comes in and has this, what can you do? If you're like, this is definitely from a bereavement, she's stressed. Can you put her in a coma? Like, can you just sedate her so she's not thinking about the sad stuff until it sort of slowly processes? Or is it like, we just got to wait it out and see if you're strong enough to get past
it? Like, if you postpone it, it just happens when she wakes up. Like,
right, right.
Well, to your point, yeah, the doctor says, should we even be bothering with trying to put people on these medications?
Yeah.
It's possible that with basic medical support for the patient, the heart may unbreak itself.
I mean, the other option is just don't ever love anybody. And then they can't
your
be
heart
taken
can
from.
Never be
is
broken.
That good advice? Should I do that? No. Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, sort of. Earthquakes in New Zealand can do it. So.
Well, I mean, I imagine it was the earthquake killed some relatives. Like, I don't think anyone was feeling bereaved by the physical fact of the earthquake. It's what happened in the aftermath of that, surely.
Yeah, I just clicked on the article, and the title of the article is not clear.
Well, that's on them. So, we'll have to assume.
I cannot give you a good answer for that. I'm sorry. Next link.
Next link.
All right. This next one is from Mashable, and it's called NASA Scientists Want to Solve a Mystery. Why did life turn left? And what they mean by this is that in three-dimensional space, all amino acids, which are the building blocks of life, have a right-handed and a left-handed version. So each of these molecules has a central carbon atom with other atom groups attached, and those groups can be stuck on in one of two orientations, kind of like how a thumbs up on one hand is a mirror image of your other hand. But one of the mysteries of life is that while both left and right amino acids are found in the universe in general, only left-handed versions are found in living organic material. And for a long time, we haven't been able to answer the question of whether left-handed amino acids are necessary for life for some reason, or whether it was just a coin flip somewhere very early on in evolution. And scientists have recently been experimenting with building right-handed proteins since we do have all of the materials readily available. And this research is actually pretty controversial because it could theoretically lead to a new form of life known as mirror bacteria.
Oh, no.
Yes, which scientists warn could be devastating if it ever became infectious because our immune systems would be completely defenseless against them.
Yeah, in Star Trek.
Is that a thing in Star Trek?
It's the mirror world in Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. I mean, theoretically, yes. And maybe they grow goatees, too. I don't know.
I would say they'd be the evil, but I think we're the evil
That's
side.
Right. We're the evil ones. But, you know, like we said, they do exist. And hypothetically, if it is a coin flip, alien life could potentially be right-handed. Or if there's something special about being left-handed, then that, of course, gives us a different set of predictions about alien life. And one of the reasons that scientists have been guessing that there might be something special about being left-handed in particular is that over the years, as we've analyzed the chemical properties of various meteorites that have fallen to Earth, we have found that they tend to be made up of roughly 60% left-handed amino acids and only 40% right-handed. And if you subscribe to the possibility that life first came to Earth on the surface of a meteorite, then that right there could explain why we're left-handed, because statistically it was just more probable. On the other hand, everything we've tested so far has, by definition, come from our solar system. So it's possible that there could be other solar systems out there with their attendant meteors, which were majority right-handed. So scientists who study this sort of thing were extremely excited when the OSIRIS-REx mission, which we've talked about on the podcast before, went out to take a sample of the asteroid Bennu, which is a so-called ancient asteroid that is understood to be older than our solar system. And they had kind of envisioned two possibilities, either majority left or potentially majority right, which would be very exciting. Instead, however, they found that Bennu was pretty much split dead even between the two. According to Danny Glavin, a senior scientist on the study, quote, "I have to admit, I was a little disillusioned. I felt like this invalidated 20 years of research in our lab and my career." So, but it's not all bad news, because while this may mean that all the meteorites in our immediate vicinity are simply contaminated by Earth and Bennu is more representative of the universe at large, it could also mean that if we do find an extrasolar asteroid that does have an imbalance, That could be an indication that it came from another solar system with some form of life.
That's only left and right. There's just two.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And it's all amino acid. Like whatever amino acid you can find, it has a mirrored pair, which is kind of insane. I mean, it does make sense that we would have to be made up of only one. Because it's like interlocking bricks. Like the once you've built something on a left-handed, it can only fit with another left-handed, and it just spirals from there. But it is fascinating. I did read a Neal Stephenson book once that was positing the possibility of right-handed alien life. And one of the things that would happen is like it had food, it had plants, and you could eat them, and they would just go right through you. You just fully undigested come out at the other end because your body was like, this is like a rock. I don't know what to do with it.
You love the deep nerdery to come up to something very concrete like that.
Yeah, but also describing pooping because that's what they were doing. Oh, yeah. So like, we're going to test this. So anyway, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Popular Science. It's titled, Fungus Infected Zombie Spiders Discovered in Northern Ireland.
Oh.
Yeah. And they're not very pretty, y'all. They are basically these orb-weaving cave spiders, you know, the really big ones. But they're covered in a white fungus that kind of looks like if you, I don't know, battered something in dough. And there's like little tendrils that almost look edible, except that, you know, if you were up close, you would not feel that way at all.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're making them sound kind of delicious, like a battered onion ring or something. But no, they're gross. Okay, I'll take
your
word.
Yes, very gross. Like battered onion ring that's been out for too long and it's a little, I mean, it's mold, okay?
Right, like one you'd find in your car 4 weeks later.
Yeah. So while filming a documentary in Northern Ireland, a team of scientists discovered a new fungus that appears to manipulate spiders' behavior and turn them into, quote, zombies. The fungus named Gibellula attenboroughi, I wonder where that came from.
Attenboroughi.
is described in a study published January 24th in the journal Fungal Systematics and Evolution. The shaded orb weaver, or orb weaving cave spider, appears to serve as the fungus's primary host. The novel fungus was initially found during the filming of the BBC series Winter Watch in Northern Ireland in 2021. The infected specimen was spotted on the ceiling of an abandoned gunpowder storeroom. Which
Sorry, so many details, right?
Yeah. The images that the team took indicated that some new fungal species might be infecting the spider. Gibellula attenboroughi potentially releases fungal spores that can manipulate the spider's activity. After a closer look, more of these infected spiders were found on the roof or wall of caves in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. According to the authors, the spiders appeared to have left their webs or lairs and migrated to die when exposed to the fungus. Cultures taken from these fungi show behavioral changing metabolites, including dopamine. The electrical signals emitted by king oyster mushrooms can also be used to control the movements of a biohybrid robot developed by a team from Cornell University and University of Florence in Italy. There's lots of links to all these different details. They're kind of just throwing it all at us here. And the authors believe that their role in spider population dynamics warrants further study, as does the metabolites they produce, which enables them to exploit such a highly specific ecological niche. As you might guess, attenboroughi is named after famed broadcaster and natural historian Sir David Attenborough. Several other species have been named in honor of the naturalist, including an egg-laying mammal called Attenborough's long-beaked echidna, the miniature orchid Lepanthes attenboroughi, Attenborough's black-eyed satyr butterfly, Eupsia attenboroughi, and the ghost shrimp, or Tenochiloides attenboroughi. I got it.
This is such a bad idea, because like 150, 200 years from now, someone's going to be looking at all these animals and their Latin names and go, oh, these must have a connection. Like biologically, there must be a reason that these are all named the same. It's like, no, he was a TV guy and we liked him. That's what it was.
Yeah. And eventually they like trace it all the way back to his DNA somehow. And they're like, wow, they must have solved human animal gene synthesis. Yeah, yeah. Something like that. Our poor descendants from like 200 years later. Yeah.
I mean, listen, they're going to be busy rebuilding society. Yeah, it's going to be a while before.
Yeah, they'll have other things to focus on. It's fine.
Right.
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from Discover. And this one hits me personally. Regrowing teeth is on the horizon and may represent the future of dentistry.
Oh.
I've had to have a couple teeth pulled. I come from a whole family of teeth pulling and just bad dentistry. And like my mom has had all of them removed and put in bridges and just a nightmare of pain too. Yeah. What they don't put in here, they just say it's all about money, but it's about pain too, because that hurts and it takes you out for a couple of weeks. So what if instead they could regrow their pearly whites at a fraction of the cost? Approaches that replace rather than patch up teeth with crowns or fillings may be closer than we think. Scientists have been exploring multiple methods in the past few decades, including RNA-based medicine, stem cell therapy, and mineral regeneration. Mm. So the idea of regrowing teeth isn't so far-fetched. This is what's weird, because humans once had the ability to grow a third set.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea.
I went to camp as a child with a girl who just had three sets of teeth. And she said it was like really common in her family. She had baby teeth. She lost them. She grew in baby teeth. She lost them. She grew in permanent teeth. It was, she was just like, yeah, this is what happens in my world.
Right. Now, she wasn't also related to her brother. Sorry.
Right. I don't think so. I can't say I dug that deep into her family tree, but.
So Katsu Takahashi, a researcher at Osaka, is leading a team to do just that. Their premise is based on the notion that humans still possess the buds necessary to grow that long lost third set. The problem is a pesky molecule named USAG1 or USAG1. It keeps getting in the way. The molecule squashes growth and seems intent on controlling how many teeth adults have in their mouth. In 2023, Takahashi's research group announced that it had developed a medicine to turn that molecule off. The approach involves using RNA to administer antibodies against USAG1. And then we can just keep growing teeth like sharks.
But is it targeted, or is it like you trigger this and now you're getting a full set of teeth, even if only one of them needs to be replaced?
I'm not sure. Yes, right now, yes. Yeah, because the team has already shown that the medicine works in animals and is now being treated on humans. So if those clinical trials find the medicine to be both safe and effective, it could be widely available as close as 2030.
Mm. Right about the time I'm going to be losing all my teeth, apparently.
Yeah. Right. Stem cells also seem like a promising approach. The team at the University of Washington School of Dentistry in 2023 created organoids from stem cells that secrete the proteins that then form enamel. It might be possible to patch up teeth with this approach. The team envisions using it as a, quote, living filling that would essentially regrow space formed by a cavity, which would be awesome, too.
Yeah, that seems way better, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just because I'm envisioning people like when a tooth comes in for a child, it shoves other teeth out of the way. It's difficult when a new tooth is growing in, even if it's supposed to. I can't imagine trying to go through that unless it's like you've lost so many teeth. There's plenty of space. It's not a problem. But if you've got one missing tooth and you're trying to jam a new one up into that space, I think there's possibility for a lot of pain, a lot of like if you've gone and had braces, now that's all ruined. I feel like fixing the teeth you have seems better.
I also read about this that there's a possibility that it does not differentiate from your wisdom teeth. So you might have to get those re-removed or something like that. But
if we were supposed to remove those in the first place.
Yeah.
So a similar approach leans in, you know, repairing enamel by growing minerals rather than living cells, right? Same idea. Let's just put some stuff on top of it and it'll grow on there.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2019, a team demonstrated that this was possible by chemically producing a gel containing calcium phosphate. After creating the concoction, scientists from the Jing University School of Medicine in China applied it to damaged tooth samples. The gel formed a 3 micrometer thick layer of enamel, according to the group. So wait a minute, are you telling me those toothpastes that say they regrow enamel are full of it?
I get a little conspiracy theory oriented when it comes to toothpaste. Like genuinely, because so a lot of toothpastes contain glycerin. And the reason that's used is because it fills little microscopic holes in your teeth. And that allows that doesn't allow bacteria to get in there and form. However, it also doesn't allow your teeth to naturally remineralize those holes. So yes, it stops you from getting a cavity, but it also sort of holds you in this position of continually needing that toothpaste. But I, listen, I'm not trying to go all I did my own research on the internet kind of about it. So
yeah, there's also nanohydroxyapatite, which is actually shown to basically plug up those holes with the same sort of material that teeth themselves use. So it does actually repair the enamel as well. And those are commercially available toothpaste at this point.
Well, there you go.
They're commercially available. Like, you don't have to get it from your dentist. You
can, yeah.
From your
yeah,
research exactly. team at the university.
Yeah. If you just search like nano hydroxy, whatever appetite, it'll autocomplete. I don't know how to spell it.
Right. But it still won't grow my two missing teeth.
No.
No, it's not growing teeth from scratch. You could sculpt them. Like, take the toothpaste. Sculpt a little like just mashed potato mountain out of it. Stick it in
stick
there.
It back there. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Right.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. This next one is from SmithsonianMag.com, and it's called How Do Polar Bears Keep Ice Off Their Fur? And this wasn't something I'd ever thought about until they said it, but I realized it's true. I've never seen a picture of a polar bear with ice on its fur. They're always super clean. And now a new study has figured out why. So senior author Bodil Holst, a physicist at the University of Bergen in Norway, was inspired to investigate polar bear fur after watching a TV quiz program. And they don't say what the circumstances were beyond that, but she sort of had this shocking realization for herself that every polar bear she'd ever seen had been ice-free. So she gathered an international team of researchers who compared ice resistance in four materials. Polar bear fur, both washed and unwashed, human hair, and hair-based ski equipment coated in fluorocarbons, which is done intentionally to keep the ice off. And I have no idea what hair-based ski equipment is, but I'm guessing it's some kind of synthetic fur collar on a jacket, maybe. I hope. I don't know. As for where they got the human hair, it came from another researcher in the study named Julian Carillon. He said, quote, "It wasn't that pleasant to do. I had to let my hair get very greasy over a week, which did not look very good. I then shaved it off as close as I could to the scalp, which was tough on account of the greasiness. This also left me with a bald head in the cold month of January last year." So he seems bitter, is the point.
Wait, did he need to go all the way to the scalp?
I mean, I don't know how long his hair was. Okay. Like, maybe they couldn't convince any of the, like, hard rockers in the team to do it. But.
Right.
At that point, they placed a block of ice on all four materials and measured how much force was required to slide that block off of the material. And the article doesn't mention how well the ski jacket did, which I suspect means it did the best. But there is no question that the unwashed polar bear fur did much better than the human hair. And more to the point, the washed polar bear fur did about as badly as human hair, indicating that it is the oils or sebum in the fur that makes it so functional rather than the fur itself. They then did a chemical analysis of the sebum and identified cholesterol, diacylglycerols, and fatty acids as its primary components. Notably, it did not contain squalene, which is a fatty oil found in the hair of humans, sea otters, and many aquatic mammals. So they're thinking that it may actually be this lack of squalene that makes it a superior blend. It's also worth noting that this is merely giving us a potential why to something that we have anecdotally known for a long time. A biologist with Polar Bears International named Jeff York confirmed that the polar bears they interact with are always dry. Quote, "When we get them on the ground and they're safely sedated." So they're not walking up and petting them. They're tranking them and then finding out they're dry. Meanwhile, Inuit tribes have a long tradition of attaching little scraps of polar bear fur to the feet of their wooden stools so that they won't stick to the surface of the ice. And aside from keeping your furniture mobile in the Arctic, the researchers say this could help us develop better synthetic materials that could hopefully replace those fluorocarbons in the ski jacket, which are PFAS or forever chemicals, and thus allow us to keep things ice-free without destroying the environment. We could also, for the record, just make polar bear fur coats a new fashion item, but I'm not sure the bear population would appreciate that.
Yeah, I don't know how polar bears smell.
That's a good point. They didn't mention that at all.
Is it good? Is it bad? Because it may be fine.
Yeah, it's kind of oily. I imagine it smells gamey, even if it's not a bad smell. It definitely probably smells a little animalistic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you made a synthetic version, you could probably put some scents or something in there right. So it wasn't
as... Put patchouli oil in there and it's fine.
Exactly. I'm personally more concerned about the... have y'all heard of growler bears?
No.
It's a new thing. So because of climate change, polar bears are coming farther south. And they're coming into the range of where grizzly bears live.
Oh,
and some of them have been mating. And now you're having these crossbreeds that they're calling growler bears. And they say it's actually a really big problem because they have all of the violence and strength of a polar bear, but they're not afraid of humans. Where a polar bear sticks to itself, a grizzly bear is like, nah, I'm going right on in and eating what I want. And so they're saying they're more dangerous, is it?
Yeah.
And it's very clear that they chose growler instead of pizzly bear. So. Next link.
Next link.
This article also comes to us from Smithsonian Mag, titled, Officials are offering $1 million to anyone who can decode this ancient script.
Ooh.
So, more than 5,300 years ago, a civilization emerged among the lush basins of the Indus River in present-day northwest India and Pakistan. Its residents, mostly farmers and traders, lived in cities of baked brick, making it one of the world's earliest urban civilizations. But around 2500 BCE, residents migrated away from the big cities like Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, with estimated peak populations of 80,000 residents combined, and dispersed into smaller villages in the foothills of the Himalayas. Eventually, the Indus Valley civilization faded away. It left behind many artifacts and archaeological sites that have kept scholars busy for centuries, many featuring a mysterious script that nobody has been able to read. Regina Sienra writes for My Modern Met, the reason behind its demise remains a mystery, as do the rules and beliefs of the society, all possibly locked behind their yet-to-be-deciphered language. To encourage the decipherment of the ancient Indus script, the government of Tamil Nadu, a state in southern India, announced a massive cash prize for anyone, scholar or amateur, who can crack the code and begin the process of better understanding the enigmatic Indus Valley civilization. M.K. Stalin, the chief minister of Tamil Nadu, according to the Hindustan Times, says, I announce a cash prize of $1 million to individuals or organizations that decipher the script to the satisfaction of archaeological experts. Stalin's announcement comes on the heels of a recent archaeological study that suggests similarities between the mysterious Indus script and ancient graffiti in Tamil Nadu on the other side of the country. In the study, K. Rajan, an archaeologist at Pondicherry University, and R. Sivananthan, the deputy director of the state's archaeological department, digitized 15,000 graffiti-marked pot shards from 140 archaeological sites in Tamil Nadu and compared them against 4,000 examples of the Indus Valley script. They found that nearly 60% of the signs matched and 90% shared parallels. While the study could indicate cultural contact or shed light on the migration of the Indus people across modern-day India, the authors emphasized that their study took a morphological approach rather than a linguistic one. That is, aside from stirring up Tamil Nadu's interest in the far-flung Indus Valley, it hasn't brought archaeologists any closer to deciphering the million-dollar script. So it's kind of like they studied the structure of it overall rather than actually getting towards any language.
Mm-hmm.
The Indus script is particularly perplexing because it tends to occur in short inscriptions, usually around 5 symbols long. That hasn't stopped amateurs from giving it their best shot, even before Stalin's $1 million incentive. Rajesh P. N. Rao, a computer scientist at the University of Washington who studies the Indus script, tells Sutik Biswas of BBC News that he receives emails every week from enthusiasts who claim they've solved it and that the case is closed. But the case is not closed, and Rao thinks that previous efforts to infuse the script with spiritual and religious meaning ignore the fact that the script has mostly been found on objects of commerce. The typical layout includes signs running across the top of the seal with an animal figure underneath. Scholars like Rao have increasingly turned to computer science and machine learning tools to identify patterns in the arrangement of these signs and symbols. Using a dataset of Indus signs, for instance, Nisha Yadav, a computer scientist at the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research in Mumbai, determined that 67 signs account for about 80% of the written script. Yadav told BBC News, "We still don't know whether the signs are complete words, or part of sentences. Our understanding is that the script is structured and there is an underlying logic in the writing." So, if you're interested, I don't see a direct link in this article to where you can actually solve it. But I'm sure if you Google, you will find it. And who knows, you might be the next million-dollar leading expert.
I'm hoping that it's like the Ian Nasir tablet that we have, where it's like, it's people complaining. I want it to be fun, not just like, here's a product and its price. I want drama is what I want in this translation. And maybe that's what all the people who are like case closed, they're like, I've decided what it is. This is the most fun translation, even if it's not accurate.
They're just writing, I don't know if fan fiction is the right word, but something like that.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include female narcissism is often misdiagnosed, Earth's crust is peeling away under California, and are dogs or cats smarter? So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on daminteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/daminteresting week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.